where we go back, back, and back into the deep, dark vaults of CBC Radio's past.
Reporting for Ogilvy Flour Mills, your women's editor, Kate Aitken.
Hello, everyone.
Project 60.
Good afternoon. This is Vicki Gabbaro.
Welcome to the Inside Track.
Radio Free Friday.
The Christmas tree, mistletoe, the fireplace, giving gifts, they're all well-known symbols of Christmas, of course. In fact, they can seem so obvious that you could be forgiven for thinking they have always been a part of the Christmas tradition, but you would be wrong. Margaret Visser is a cultural anthropologist who for years was a frequent guest on CBC Radio, talking about the origin of everyday things, how everything from salt to having a bath, how to arrange our hair to the way we eat dinner are deeply rooted in our history and traditions. Today, in keeping with the season, we have some segments with Margaret Visser, where she examines the history of some of our most well-known Christmas symbols. Take this one about the fireplace. It's from 1984, where she's in conversation with Peter Zosky.
One of the things that we don't realize is if we have a fireplace, it's always against the wall, right? And people sort of sit in a semicircle.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, and this is very important for the fireplace, it was in the middle of the house. And we have to think of a cave, you know, we're all these sort of hairy people and we're sitting in a circle around the fire.
Yeah.
You talk about the family circle, right? And this is where it comes from. We said we're sitting around the central fire. And the fireplace is centrality itself. It's the center of the house. Interestingly, in Latin, the word fireplace is focus. So the word focus comes from the fireplace. So you see how important it is. It's a focal point in any house.
Now, what about the seasonal nature of the importance of the fireplace, the mythology of Christmas as it glimmers and flickers in the fire?
Christmas makes a big thing of the fireplace. You have the mantelpiece. We always have, by the way, a mantelpiece with a clock on top, which I think is important. I'll say why in a minute. And you have your precious ornaments on it. And you have, at Christmas time, you put your Christmas cards on it, you decorate it, and you hang up your stocking in front of it. Now, when we recall that the fireplace was the focus of the house, it also is the place where we feel together. We feel together as a family, the family circle. We also, when we have a friend visiting us, we introduce, this is in ancient times, and it still is true in a sense, you bring them into the living room, right? In the past, you'd bring your friend or a stranger, whoever it was, into the house, and they would have to touch the hearth, the fireplace.
Mm-hmm. Literally reach out and
touch
and put a hand on
it. Because
on
it shows that they've been introduced from the outside into the center of the house.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big, an opposition is always made between the inside and the outside, the center and the boundary. And it's where hospitality is shown to guests. So immediately we start to ring a bell about Christmas, right? The hospitality aspect, the togetherness aspect. When people get together around a fire, and Canadians do this a lot because they have camping fires and things like this. It's amazing what happens to human beings. They become very special. There's a philosopher
when you say Canadians, because you know what happens to Canadians when they get around a fire?
Well, they sing.
They sing, right? That's right.
That's part
makes
of
you sing.
Christmas carols.
Oh, so that's
together.
All right. I thought I was being flippant,
no,
but no.
No, you couldn't be more right.
Right.
You get together around a fire.
Mm-hmm.
There's a philosopher who lives in the United States. He's a Frenchman, and he talks about the betrayal of Jesus by the woman who was warming her hands. Remember, she denied him.
Mm-hmm.
He says that he's talking about how people behave around fires. He says it's not by accident that it happens when they're sitting around a fire, because people, when they're around a fire, are together, which is very nice, but they exclude, even attack, other people in their togetherness. And this is very interesting about Christmas. You see, there's a whole guilt trip that happens at Christmas time. We leave, by being together, we leave people out. So there's a dark side to Christmas. There always has been. Now, to go on about the fireplace for a minute. The fireplace, I said, was round. Round in our culture is female, invariably. That's the reason why. It's very interesting. You won't go into that now, but the hearth was round.
No, let's pass
it
on.
It contained fire.
Yeah.
Fire is male. The hearth is a sexual symbol of the couple.
The male
containing
the female.
The female containing the male.
The male within the female.
And this is the hearth, and you might sometimes wonder, why does Father Christmas come down the chimney? It's very
Freudian. I didn't before this very moment.
You might also ask why he's wearing red, which is a phallic color. And anyway, it's I say this, this is absolutely dead serious. This, the hearth has always been representative of fertility, prosperity, the center of the house, just like the marriage bed. Right? That's absolutely basic. And it also represents, and this might be more difficult to explain, because it is round and female, it is virginal. That may seem like a paradox, but the actual round hearth itself is virginal. Why? Because it's immovable. A female...
And virginity is immobility?
Virginity is immobility. Why? Because when a female marries, she leaves home. It's one of the great paradoxes about marriage. Anyway, we can't go into too much detail, but the reason why
you can't tantalize me like that.
I don't want to get too sort of lectury about this, but it's all terribly, terribly interesting, and it goes in for miles in all directions, the subject. Okay? But the reason why I'm introducing it here is because it explains why in ancient Rome the hearth of the state, because in ancient Rome and Greece they had a hearth of the state as well as a hearth of the private house, the hearth of the state was looked after by Vestal
virgins. What does Vestal mean?
Means to do with the hearth.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Yes. Hestia is the goddess of the hearth in Greek, and Vesta in Roman. It's the same, say, in Latin, it's the same.
All word. My life, when I've heard of Vestal virgins, I've been hearing of virgins of the hearth.
Absolutely. So, and it's very important that they're virgins. Okay. We'll have to move on from there because I couldn't explain it all the way it should be. But the thing about the hearth is it represents this. If you think of a compass, okay, a compass has two arms. One is the center of the circle, immovable. The other one turns and is the boundary of the circle, and it moves.
Oh, that kind of compass. The compass that draws
yes,
the circle.
Yes, a compass with two legs, I would call them.
But okay.
Oh, two legs.
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. So the hearth then represents the female who's in, her place is in the home,
right.
Remember, standing still in the center, whereas the male turns, moves on the outside.
Okay. Yeah?
Now, the hearth is, therefore, a symbol of permanence in space, doesn't move. It is also continuity in time. What happens at Christmas, and this is why the fireplace is very important at Christmas, is we reach the turning point in the year. We reach the darkest time. In fact, the darkest day of the year is the 21st of December. But we celebrate Christmas on the 25th of December. Very interesting. I'll come to that in a minute. Because we've reached a turning point. In other words, we are celebrating the fact that we are going to go on from here. We've reached the darkest point, but a light shines in the dark. And it may seem to you that I've left Christianity way behind in all this.
No, but
not at all.
You just antedated Christianity.
Christianity has always done this. It has always reached into the far past and is incredibly capacious. It's a capacious religion. That when it finds symbolism in another religion or in the past that suits its message, it will use it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And also, furthermore, of course, we're talking about folklore, not religion now. But folklore can be used by religion. And that's what happens at Christmas. So what we get then is the sun will return. Sol Invictus, as the Mithraics called it, the unconquered sun. It may seem to you the sun has been conquered by the darkness, but we are celebrating the fact that we believe that the sun, in fact, is being reborn at this minute. And Sol Invictus, interestingly, was this festival of the Mithraic religion, which was celebrated on the 25th of December.
Sol Invictus.
Interesting, yes, the unconquered
unconquerable
sun.
Unconquered.
And of course the sun is one of the great symbols for Jesus Christ, the sun of
and birth and
light in the dark, the new birth, the sun of justice, etc. And of course you think of the manger with the straw is very often in iconography made to look like a sun symbol, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the thing about fire is a paradoxical thing, it destroys. However, if you can keep a fire going, fire becomes a symbol of continuance through our effort. It's a sign that human beings are keeping it up. Mm-hmm. You think of things like the unknown soldier has a fire. Fire also represents a connection between one place and another. In the ancient world, when you started a new colony,
You took fire
from the hearth of your home country, and you carried it away to the new colony, and you set up and you started a new fire.
We do that very clearly with the Olympics to this day, carry the torch from the previous country to the next country,
and
bring the fire and start the fire, which is a symbol of the eternal flame.
So. Absolutely, and time, continuance in time. You remember the last time it happened. And it's very interesting in Canada, you see, the patron saint of the hearth is St. Lawrence. Why? Because the poor man was grilled. Okay? That's why he's the sacred patron saint of the hearth. Now, when the French... He was grilled. His martyrdom was to be grilled alive. Okay? He was roasted.
Right.
So, poor St. Lawrence, who's the patron saint of the hearth, when the French Canadians came to Canada, what did they do? They brought the saint of the hearth with them. This is one of the reasons why St. Lawrence, is so important in French-Canadian culture. Aeneas had done the same thing. When he went from Troy to Italy, he took his household gods with him. This is one of the ways you start a new outfit, a new country,
you
a new colony.
Plank down your hearth on the foreign turf.
With a connection to the old hearth always, the continuance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at Christmas, we have a sort of symbol of this in the Yule log. I understand that people are starting to introduce this custom back in again, the sort of ski lodges and things like that. The Yule log used to be absolutely essential as a part of Christmas.
I don't even know what it is as a custom of our time. I've always thought a Yule log was simply a log in your fireplace at Yule.
It is. You're absolutely right. But it had all sorts of meaning, right? Mm-hmm. And it's very ancient, pre-Christian, this. This is the northern countries now. And what you did was you went out into the forest and you found a really old twisty bole of a tree. And you dragged it into your house with somebody sort of sitting on it. There's always a parade aspect to Christmas, by the way. Parades are very much part of Christmas. You drag the Yule in with somebody sitting on it. You then put it in your fireplace. And then you keep it alight for the 12 days of Christmas. You see, the continuance idea. The continuance, 12 days of Christmas, and also, when it's finished burning, the festival is over, because festivals always have something in them that must die, because the festival can't go on, you see.
Mm-hmm.
You can't keep on making...
So the Yule log flickers to a close.
It flickers to a close. Now, it dies. However, we keep a brand of it under the bed. Bed comes back in again. You keep it under the bed for next year, and you light the new Yule log with the brand from the old Yule log. Now, the fascinating thing is that while that log is burning, our 12 days of Christmas, which nowadays, by the way, we've reduced because we cut out the 6th of January, we brought it back to the 1st of January. Interestingly, in Christianity, one of the things that Christians often do is try and get rid of Christmas. Because one of the things that Christians often do is to try and get rid of the fun, right? They get rid of the folklore. And they've often tried to get rid of Christmas. Thanksgiving, for example, is one of the ways they try to get rid of Christmas, by having Thanksgiving instead. Well, we're sensible enough now to have both, right? But when people try to get rid of Christmas, they got rid of the three kings, which have always been very unpopular because that's the gift-giving part, which the Puritans didn't like. But we still have the 1st of January, and what we have is a period of time between Christmas and now the 1st of January when nothing happens. Right? We try to be very Puritan about it. We go back to work on Monday, but it's not serious. Nobody really thinks it's serious. And what is happening during that time? Sorry?
No, I was just thinking how true that is. I mean, it is. There is a different attitude to the world in that period of time. You do go to the office, but what do you do? You just move your envelopes around and...
It's pathetic that we should even bother, you know?
Yes, right.
But it is a fascinating phenomenon, this. It's what the anthropologists call communitas. What this means is that society as a whole opts out of the whole ball game. We all just stop, okay? Even if we pretend to go on, we really stopped. And for example, what happens in those periods of time, which is represented by our burning Yule logs, I haven't completely left the point of the fireplace, is that we all are become equal together. This is an ancient festival. It goes back to ancient Rome, where they used to have what was called the Silia, when people used to, down with hierarchy, the slave became equal to the other man. The boss had to serve his servant. And for a while, everything was turned upside down. So everybody was in communitas. They were equal. And of course, this is very germane to Christianity. Okay, so for a while, we just stop and have this communitas. Just think, for example, in Toronto, you go downtown, everybody roars at downtown and gets everything at half price.
Yes.
This is part of...
That's communitas? Satin.
That is... It's communitas. It gets us in a crowd, and it's our version of it. It's you know, it's a modern version of the same thing. Half price, everybody, you know?
Right.
We'll get them
That's
now.
That's the Saturnalia.
That's the Saturnalia aspect. And there are many others, of course. There's play acting, where we all interchange roles.
Yes.
There are games, where we introduce chance into our lives. And it goes on and on. All those aspects of Christmas are communitas.
All those bowl games that are echoing on the television, in which we're looking at athletes running up and down on plastic surfaces, we're really, that's the echo of the Saturnalian game.
Absolutely, that's human beings at play.
Yes.
And then finally, to get back to our, there is the image of the hearth as being open to heaven through the chimney and open to the earth, because it was always the root of the house, the foundation stone of the house. And what we get is a communitas of the whole of creation. Because what has happened is that the heavens have opened, God has become man has become equal, the three kings have come from all parts, from the foreigners have come to join us, the animals talk, the light comes in the darkness. In other words, and eternity is expressed, renewal is expressed, so time and eternity. In other words, we have an enormous opening of the whole world. It's a liberation of the whole world for a period of time.
Margaret Visser with Peter Zosky on Morningside in 1984. I'm Michael Enright, and you're listening to Rewind here on CBC Radio 1 and Sirius XM. Today we look at the symbols of Christmas with the help of Margaret Visser, a cultural anthropologist who looks at the origins of the everyday. Up now, the culture of giving gifts, another tradition that is inextricably associated with Christmas. Visser looks at cultures where giving is infinitely more valued than getting.
This morning you're going to talk about societies that celebrate Christmas all the time.
Well, yes, societies, that is, which are arranged around gift-giving rather than around commerce and commodities. Okay. Now, there are societies who really take gift-giving very, very seriously. It's their whole life, in a way. They're two most they're all kinds, but they're two very famous ones. One is in Melanesia. This goes on today. Right? It's called the Kula.
Mm-hmm.
In the Kula, these people circulate, when I say circulate, I really mean that, gifts among themselves, which they hand on. Now, the point about this is that somebody gives, A gives a present to B, but B then gives a present not to A, but to C.
Same present?
Same present. And it keeps on circulating. You keep this thing.
Oh, what a good idea.
You want to get rid of some of yours?
No, I will end up coming back to me. No, okay,
oh,
you keep this thing.
No,
help me, this is the Kula. I don't know about this.
No, it's absolute dynamite, this. This is fascinating. They have these shell ornaments that are totally useless. That's the point.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if they were useful, this wouldn't work. I'm going to apply this to us. This is
okay.
Later on. So they have two sets. They have a set of red necklaces, which are male and worn by women, which circulate. When I say circulate, they go by canoe from island to island. These are the islands of Melanesia.
Yeah.
Right? They take a canoe and take this necklace and they give it to somebody. Then that person keeps it for about a year, and a year later then he's got to take a canoe and go to the next island and give it to them. This goes clockwise. There is another kind of present, which is a female shell, which is worn by men, which goes counterclockwise. And the people set off on a canoe and go counterclockwise, giving these things. So what you do is they sort of cross over. So somebody gets one and gives another one that's come from his left-hand side,
yeah,
and one coming from his right. And in other words, these presents go round and round and round this society. They have all sorts of stories linked with them. People feel intense emotion about them. And if they're ill, For example, if you're sick, somebody sort of dangles a necklace in front of you and you instantly feel much, much better just for looking at this necklace. In other words, these are objects which have, adhering to them, this enormous, this honor and prestige and emotion. And the point about them is that you don't use them, and the point about them is that you give them away. You never keep them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one kind of society. Another one is very, very, very famous. It's our own British Columbia Indians.
And the potlatch.
The potlatch, the Haida Indians. They had, I should say, a very similar kind of... They gave gifts at huge ceremonies. And this is the way they made hierarchy in society, giving things, the amount you give, when you give, what you give. And they were always very, very careful, this is what you get with these gift societies, to distinguish between the gift and the honor and the emotion attaching to the thing.
You have to explain that some more. This is not the old thing that we always tell the people to whom we can only give a $1.98 pack of playing cards. It's not the gift, it's the thought.
We'll come to that. That's not without meaning. That is important. What's famous about the potlatch, people just couldn't believe this when they saw it, because it got to the point where these Indian tribes would... Within the same tribe, would dare each other, chiefs would dare each other to destroy material possessions. And he would destroy an enormous amount and say, okay, you destroy the same amount. And mm-hmm. if he couldn't, he showed that he was lower in the social scale. You know, the thing carries the honor, but the honor is not the same thing as the object. And the point is that in these societies, what is important, riches, do not consist of profits or objects that you own. Riches are the number of people you have that are your friends. And this is what gifts do. Gifts link people. Gifts cause prestige, and they give you followers, friends, people who can help you out, somebody who will build your house for you. Rather than the amount of money you have, they don't have that. They have instead friends who are willing to work on your side. So that, for example, even we ourselves, I mean, we know perfectly well that if you don't have business dealings with your relatives if you can avoid it. You don't have business dealings with your friends. Because when you do business, you do a very different thing from having a family relationship. You might have to fight with that person. You might have to argue. You might even have to cheat that person. But you don't want to do that with your family, because you never know how long this is going to cause, what trouble this is going to cause.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these are societies that think of their society as their like a family. Right? So you don't do business with them. You give to them. And still, I mean, we are not a gift society. We're a commodity or a market society. But when it comes to giving gifts, those old attitudes, those attitudes of societies like that, resurface in the most peculiar way, because it's not us. It's not usually us. And when we give gifts, even now, I mean, you give things that are, I don't know, that they're not useful. You don't give somebody a common household object. Or if you do, it's a special one.
Yes.
People used to give things like Fabergé eggs at Easter. This is, you know, some...
What do you use those for?
You
get a Fabergé egg, what do you do with it?
You just look at it and say, this is a Fabergé egg.
That's right.
And it's rather like those things that people circulated in the cooler, you know. It's a very precious object that doesn't have its preciousness is the point. I remember once I bought my husband a shaving brush. This is in Paris. And he refuses to use an electric shaver. He just hates those, right? So I bought him a shaving brush. And this woman said, it's a perfect... The woman in the shop persuaded me to buy it. She said, this is very special. It's made of badger. This isn't just your...
Badger?
I don't know whether it's its fur or its whiskers. It must be its fur. Anyway, a badger brush.
Yes.
And then she said, and here, madam, is a badger made from a badger from the high mountains. And this costs more. And I said, I've got to have that. And apparently it's soft or flexible or something. I don't know. But you pay more and it's from the high mountains. That makes it a present.
My father told me, he didn't give me a lot of good advice. One of the things he said is, if you only have $5 to give a present with, give a cake of soap. Get the very best cake of soap. In those days, that was unheard of, $5. I think that's now what you pay for your...
Yes, but right. Rather than buy a cheap version of a bigger thing.
Get the most expensive version of the little thing. And then because you are showing whatever it is you're showing.
You've taken care.
Yes.
Right? And you, it's all sort of concentrated. What you're interested in gift giving is not the thing, but what adheres to. We say it's the thought that counts, right? Or you wouldn't have bought it for yourself. That's another thing you say. You give a gift to somebody that's sort of luxurious. I mean, you, for example, and you can also insult people by what you give them. I mean, you don't give an apron to a woman. You might give an apron to a man.
Yes, because, I get aprons.
Yes, well, that's because it's amusing and it's pretty prestigious for you to cook. But if you gave one to a woman, she'd probably be annoyed. Unless it was a one with, that had something, you know, sort of musicians' signatures all over it, like the one we got from the Royal Ontario Opera. You know, their opera sells aprons with musicians' signatures on it. That makes
that would make them work very well. That would keep the egg stains off in the kitchen, wouldn't it? That'd be a wonderful thing
to have.
You can't
tell the egg stains
are Andrew Davis's signature right there. You're just as messy as if you'd paid $4 for it.
But you see the principle.
Yes.
You have to have a special thing. And notice that we also fight to give the best. Remember we saw with those dolls that you have to get that one so that you can be the one to give it. So there's a prestige in giving. And this is why we wrap everything. Americans particularly. I mean, it's extraordinary to me.
No. The Canadians can wrap right in there with the Americans. This is Do you not?
And we're spreading all over the world.
We're rappers.
Now everybody wants to rap because everybody's copying the Americans. But there was a time in where I come from, it wasn't particularly exciting wrapping up. I mean, I didn't care terribly. It's very important in some cultures. It's shown that you've taken trouble. And then the wrapping is important because you want to watch the receiver opening it, and the receiver gets pleasure out of not knowing and then having the surprise. It fascinates me. McDonald's.
This receiver gets self-conscious when that happens.
Oh,
I don't
dear.
Know if people take that into account or not, but I do get self-conscious as people are
that you won't give the right response.
Or something. You know, I got to know exactly. Yes, there's all that moment of high drama.
How am I going to respond?
What if I don't like it? What if it's
Then
a
you say,
pair of
oh,
socks?
You shouldn't have. Yes.
Just what I've always wanted, you lie.
Yeah, my seventh trivial
that's right. But the wrapping is part of the prestige, the specialness,
absolutely.
The care.
And this is why McDonald's wraps hamburgers. I mean, it's so funny. Because there's no surprise in the hamburger. That's the whole point. It can't be. It's machine tool so that it's like every other hamburger in existence. But the idea that you've got this little thing and then you open it, it's like a gift, right?
Mm-hmm.
You eat your hamburger. So they understand this. They're so clever. Wrapping makes it special somehow. And of course, you get in Italian cultures, Latin cultures, they have something called bella figura. When you give a present, and when you give a present, it's got to be large and shiny, and it's got to be huge wrapping on it, because somehow it's got to make an effect, and not only an effect to the person you're giving it to, but to all the people who are watching you give it to that
mm-hmm.
person. And I mean, this is it's very complicated. It's not a simple thing, and it's part of the linkage between people, right? And you've got to make something that with a big splash, and make a big effect. That's fa figura, you know. If it's smaller, non fa figura, it won't do. You know? So you get special shops that sell gifts. They're gift shops. They're not things. They're just
gifts. Right. Gift shop.
Yeah, right.
What about numbers of gifts? I mean, you've talked about the prestige of the individual gift. Is there more in...
Well, you can, getting lots of stuff means that lots of people think highly of you.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a singer and after the opera you get these bunches and bunches of flowers, the most bunches means the most homage, right? And then the Japanese are great on this. They have dinner parties and they give each other cups of sake. It's very complicated. It's a whole sort of a ritual. And what happens is the end of the party, the person who's been given the most cups of sake all stand, the cups stand in front of him, and you can just look around the table and you can see the most honored person there. It expresses hierarchy, expresses honor.
That's the prestige of getting, of receiving.
Yes.
But there's a similar prestige of giving, which you've taught. I mean, it's the same sort of prestige, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Being able to give, being rich enough to give. You know, funnily enough, it's North America that does this most. Things even themselves out. Where we try not to have rich people giving out handouts when they feel like it. That's one of the main tenets of our society. We try to prevent
that. We don't have
that.
The Duke coming to give
the
turkey.
No, we have a right to it.
Right.
Okay? So that's very important to us. But yet, in North America, there's this tremendous tradition of the rich sort of endowing scholarships, building museums, you know. The people expect the rich to put on entertainment, you know, decorate the big store windows so we can bring our children and look. We think that the rich should give us that. And there's a prestige for them in being able to do that.
Is there a prestige for me, not rich, giving to charity? Is that part of the same? Giving to charity,
yes.
Is that part of the same?
Giving to charity is very special because when you give to charity, you don't know who you're giving it to. You don't know who the present is going to. The most extraordinary one of all is giving blood. I mean, you give blood, you don't know who's going to get that blood. And it's very, blood is full of symbolism, of course. It's brotherhood, it's relationship. You talk about blood relatives, yeah, and so on. And somebody's going to share your blood. I gave blood recently. It was very interesting. I gave blood, and afterwards I got this cookie. you know, and people thought, I mean, obviously they think that I needed to be nourished or something. That's the outer reason. But it isn't that. And this is something we're going to talk about in the next program. It's a sort of reciprocity. You gave blood, so we've got to give you something. So they give you this
but
cookie.
A cookie? A cookie for your blood?
Yes, well they say, but you need to eat
some. What kind of cookie? Chocolate chip?
They'll get a little bit of jam in
there. Oh, no.
And then, this is what interested me. This is new. But this also shows an understanding of how gift-giving works. They gave me a sticker saying, "Be nice to me, I have given blood." So you walk around sort of proclaiming to everybody that you have given. So notice the prestige comes back.
Margaret Visser in 1985 with Peter Zosky. Up next, we turn our attention to mistletoe, that prickly, parasitic branch that's hung up in houses around this time of year. It's not meant just for decoration. Tradition says people are supposed to kiss under it. In this segment, Margaret Visser talks about the origins of the custom.
Where did mistletoe and what we think of it meaning start to mean what we think of it meaning?
Right.
When?
Well, it's very, very old. I mean, mistletoe has fascinated people for thousands of years. If you read Aeneid, the golden bough that Aeneas has to cut when he goes to the underworld is almost certainly mistletoe. Virgil talks about mistletoe in the same context. He says it's like mistletoe, and it almost certainly is. It grows on an oak, and Aeneas has to cut a bough to enable him to get into the underworld, because the underworld, of course, is what human beings are not allowed access to. So mistletoe has all kinds of interesting... You can find the reasons for the powers that mistletoe has by looking at the plant. It's this bizarre plant that lives in the air. So this is a plant that doesn't have roots. In fact, it grows into the tree that hosts it. And very rarely on oak, because oak has a lot of tannin, which usually kills the plant. So it's rarely on oak. And it was when it was on oak that the Druids and the Norse peoples, and also the same tradition as in Virgil, it becomes a sacred plant, because the oak tree was the sacred tree.
They harvested it for sacred purposes?
That's right. And when you harvested it, Pliny tells us that the Druids would cut the mistletoe down, and above all, it must never touch the ground. So obviously not touching the ground is one aspect of it. Another aspect of it is the fact that it's alive and bearing fruit when the tree it's actually living on is dead. So, and it's in the middle of winter and it's bearing fruit. So it's a sign of life in the middle of winter. It's also very slimy, and this is very interesting because I've said this
before.
We have a very
business thing here. A slimy thing.
Slimy thing. It has these white slimy seeds. In fact, the slime is very important for the life of mistletoe because birds eat those seeds, and then the seeds pass through the gut of the bird. And when it's sitting on a branch and it shits on the branch, the seeds sticks.
That's what it does.
The old Anglo-Saxon word.
Well, we know what you mean, certainly.
Right. And it sits. So the seeds it sticks, right? Yes. That's why it's slimy. Now, the mistletoe that's famous and has all the mythology, and I'll talk about the mythology in a minute, it's really interesting, is the European mistletoe. What we use in North America is a different genus. It's the Phoradendron. In Europe, it's the Vicium album, the white viscous thing, mm-hmm. slimy. Huh? Now, what's happening with mistletoe is that it crosses categories, it crosses boundaries. It's a plant, but it lives in the air. It's slimy, which in our culture is a crossing of categories. We hate things that are neither solid nor liquid. Mm-hmm. In our culture, slime is scary, right? And it's still, this is part of it, right, in this particular plant. And it's alive when everything else is dead, so it crosses categories. Now, the ancient Norse myth of mistletoe is about Balder the Beautiful. You have to say the beautiful because the word Balder doesn't sound beautiful to us. But Balder the Beautiful was the god of light and the god that everybody loved, the good god of Norse mythology. And Balder started having dreams that he was going to die because Norse gods could die. Well, they didn't tend to, but they could. And he dreamt that he would die. So Frigg, another god, collected all the things that had ever been created in the universe and made each one swear that it would not harm Balder. And everybody said, plants, animals, rocks, water, everything swore it would not harm Balder. So Balder said, we've saved you, Balder. And he said, they'd be happy. And then all the gods stood around him. This is very interesting. The gods stood around him and threw stuff at him, and nothing harmed him. They threw stones, and very interesting, this picture of this god standing in the middle, being had things thrown at him. Right? And then eventually, they all said, you see, he's saved. And then Loki, that's the mischievous god, said, oh, this is ridiculous. And he just out of sheer mischief, he went around trying to check up on whether everything had been covered by this oath. And he found out. Mistletoe had been left out.
Because it's not in the category?
And because it just falls out of
but
the category.
But Frigg slipped up.
He slipped up. And so Loki made this an arrow out of mistletoe wood, gave it to a blind god, mm-hmm. and the blind god threw it at Balder, and he was killed. An enormous lamentation. This is the death of light, right? Enormous lamentation all over the earth, and Balder's body was taken and burnt. Now, one of the things that happens with mistletoe is that every year, this is the custom was, to burn it once a year on New Year's. And while you were burning the mistletoe, you set up another piece of mistletoe, which hung in the house all year round. It was protective against fire. Now, the interesting thing was, I said, notice the story, the god being pelted,
yeah.
is definitely behind this lies human sacrifice. It's a human sacrifice story. It's one of those myths that describe how once a human being had to be killed so that everything else would work. The sun would rise, the plants
just
would grow.
Just translated into a god.
And translated into a god. And mistletoe has to do with human sacrifice. There's no question about it. And you know the great, great book, James Fraser's book, The Golden Bough, is all about mistletoe and what mistletoe meant. And his theory is that when they cut the mistletoe off the oak tree, they were cutting the soul away. In other words, killing the oak tree. So it's a death symbol.
How did it get? If this isn't too leaping forward, a question. How did it get from this dark and gloomy symbolism, painful symbolism? To the happy thing that it is in our houses at Christmas. We kiss under it.
That's right. Yes, what you see, now, from all the breaking...
I may change my plan, my mistletoe policy. I'm not stepping under that thing.
Right.
Killed the gods.
That, right. Well, what happens is that mistletoe, like the Christmas tree, like all Christmas greenery, is the outside brought inside mm-hmm. into the house. And before the British had a Christmas tree, they had a thing called the kissing bough, which was a greenery, which was actually a hawthorn bush originally, but it becomes like a wreath. It's hung in the middle of the living room, it's on the ceiling, hanging up, and with mistletoe on it. Now, what that stood for was the Saturnalian aspect of Christmas, which means that everything is turned upside down at Christmas. So what it means is that there's liberty proclaimed. You can do all kinds of things during the 12 days of Christmas. Remember, there were 12 days of Christmas, not just one then. For during those 12 days, all kinds of things are turned upside down. And one of the things was that men are allowed to kiss women, just any woman, no matter who it is, and she can't tell them not to. So this is liberty. Yeah. Women can't tell men not to, it's liberty. But anyway, it's a man's world, okay? So men were allowed to kiss any woman they could catch underneath that mistletoe as part of the Saturnalian aspect of Christmas. And what you see, one of the things that happened also is because mistletoe is to do with human sacrifice, was sacred to the Druids and so forth, it was rejected by Christianity. I mean, it was not allowed into churches, except in some churches, and one of them is York Minster in England, they used to bring mistletoe and put it on the altar. This is so typical. So you ban something, something's absolutely forbidden. But every now and then you take that very thing and you bring it in and you put it on the altar. And this was done at Christmas time. And during that time, liberty was proclaimed. You celebrated liberty. See, what's happening is that in societies that are very, very structured, every now and then you break down that structure and you enact freedom from it. You say, to hell with the structure. We're just not going to have this structure. We're not going to have inequality. We're not going to have men and women separated. We're not going to and you celebrate that for a brief contained period.
But in a Christmas,
in order that you can go back to
holiday,
to
or at a holiday that was
that's right, a Christian holiday, the very thing that is forbidden in a church, you bring into the church to celebrate the breaking down of the structure. So it's this is a very widespread strategy in all religions that have this. But this is what the one that's to do with mistletoe. So and mistletoe also is a sex thing. It's white, viscous stuff. It's obviously a semen symbol. So it's got all these things. It's the
forgotten. What about its greenness? Isn't its greenness important?
Well, at Christmas we bring green things into the house. It celebrates the fact that there will be life. Remember that the winter solstice, this is the 22nd of December, the winter solstice, the night before the 22nd of December is the longest night of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the darkest. You know. From that moment, things start to look up. And this is one of the things that Christmas celebrates, the turning in the year. So you bring in all these green things into the house to say, well, there is going to be life. And particularly if this plant can have fruit, which is what mistletoe has, which is what holly has. That's why holly is very important at Christmas. So this fruiting plant. Then there is that other aspect of Christmas, which is that Saturnalian one. It's insane. The categories are broken down. We brought trees into the house, right? It's that attitude of let's break it all down.
That's a sort of silly thing when you we do it. What are you going to do today? Go and get a tree and put it into the house.
So it's rather like a mistletoe. You know, it's brought into the house and it's powerful and dangerous. And it's to do with fire. Remember, Balder was burnt. And the mistletoe keeps you safe from fire and lightning and all that.
Margaret Visser in 1985 talking to Peter Zosky about the symbols of Christmas. I'm Michael Enright, and today on Rewind we have a seasonal hour with Margaret Visser. She made it her quest to uncover and explain the intriguing and sometimes unexpected meaning of everyday objects and habits, and was for many years a frequent guest on CBC Radio. Our last segment for today is about the Christmas tree, and it's with Sheila Rogers on her show, The Arts Tonight, in 1994.
I'll tell you something that's really rather interesting. People are always sort of snotty about the plastic Christmas tree. But before the Christmas tree, this is before the 1841, when this is the great date when it was introduced from Germany into England. But before that date, in Germany as well as England, actually, they didn't have a real tree. They had a wooden pyramid, which acted as a tree. They didn't go out and chop down their trees the way we do. They actually had this thing that they brought out year after year and saved the environment and all that. So, and in fact, it's much older than the tree. bringing the tree inside. So anybody who has a plastic tree can feel perfectly happy about it.
Well, do you put candles on your tree?
No.
Because this is strictly illegal, I believe.
Is it?
Oh, well, I know people that do.
Oh, we did when we were in, and I used to live in Africa. And
yes.
We used to have this Christmas tree, and we had this fake snow, you know, cotton wool snow, which we put on the
potatoes.
We never seen snow in our lives.
Yeah. Yeah. What kind of trees did you have?
Well, we had sort of long, you know, evergreens.
Yeah.
And it's quite different from anything you have here. It's a totally different tree. But we had all the sparkle and the snow and the robin red breast. There's no such thing in Zambia. But we were these colonists, and we had to do this.
You know. Brought stuff over, right?
Yes.
Now, so the tree business really starts in 1841 in England.
In England.
But before England.
Before England. Oh, it's a Germanic thing. It was brought over by Albert, who was a German. And when Dickens first saw a tree, he called it that pretty German toy. So it's a German thing. But before that, you see, I think it's rather interesting to think of all the things that the tree displaced. In England, they had rosemary bushes and branches.
And were they decorated as well? Or
Yes, yeah. Yes. They're very, very ancient. The ancient Greeks had something which is rather like a Christmas tree called the Erisione, and they still have it in modern Greece, in Chios, for example. And this is rather like Halloween, where the children carry a branch from house to house, and it's decorated, and then they demand money and sing a song.
Lovely.
So it's sort of both Christmas and Halloween at a different time of year, mm-hmm. but it's that idea. And then there was the pyramid we were talking about. Then there's the paradise tree, which was known in the Middle Ages. And they used that in festivals, in plays, for example. It stood for the tree of life from Garden of Eden, and that was decorated with balls on it, just rather like what ours are, but it wasn't in people's private houses. Mm. And then there's the Yule log, which is a forerunner of the tree, because what you do is you bring something from the outside inside. Just as in the summer, when we have a feast, we like to go outside. In the winter, we like to bring the outside inside. And so the Yule log is a version of that. It was brought in and burnt for the 12 days of Christmas. And the tree is rather like that. We keep it for the 12 days, and it makes something different. And the fire burning, which is essential to the Christmas theme, the idea of light in darkness, which is the meaning of the Christian feast in Christmas. And also it's warmth, because we're at the darkest time of the year.
Right.
So that's the point of these lights and the candles and all that. And then the English had the kissing bough, which hung from the ceiling. And these pyramids I'm talking about really usually hung from the ceiling rather than standing on the ground. And the British had the kissing bough, which hung from the ceiling with the mistletoe in the middle, and then you kissed under the tree, under the mistletoe. But the tree came in, and then it just took over. So it came from Germany.
But there was a Catholic Protestant split, wasn't there? It wasn't right. Universally embraced.
Yes. Well, when the Reformation happened, the Protestants were very opposed to all the popish things like having statues and human beings and all those impure things.
Idolatry.
Right? Idolatry. Yeah. Yes, and the tree, the mince pie was denounced by Protestants as idolatrous.
Because Pourquoi?
No, because it was supposed to represent the manger.
Oh!
This was terribly evil.
But nothing to do with meat and fruit and all.
Oh, no. It was just because it looked like a manger. It was too close to Christ and so on. So for a long time, people tried to get rid of Christmas altogether. But the Christmas tree was a kind of answer to that Catholic thing, which was Saint Nicholas, who would appear, as he still does in Barcelona. He comes from the sea on a horse and goes through the city of Barcelona, right, giving out presents.
Yeah.
And that was got rid of. And the tree sort of takes the place of Santa Claus, who only had only just started to evolve when the tree arrived in England. But Santa Claus is a person, so the tree is more pure, it's abstract. And then, as I say in my book, and I really think it's true, it's quite modern, this. We have evolved this thing of Santa Claus being this sort of phallic symbol that comes down the chimney and leaves a present in the stocking, right? And there's this red male laughing, jolly.
I said we'd have a seasonal metaphor here or two, didn't I?
And then the tree, who's a sort of double of Santa Claus, because now Catholics accept the tree and the Protestants accept Santa Claus.
They're
so we've got there a double. Yeah. So what do we do with them? Well, one's male and the other one's female. So the tree is this woman with a skirt.
Yes,
dress,
right.
And it's,
yeah.
And it's actually sung to in Oak Tannenbaum. You know, it's Du. She called
yes,
Du.
You, the familiar.
And then she's put on, she has necklaces and earrings on and perfumes. The smell of the smell of the tree is the nicest thing about it in some ways. It, you know, that scent, it makes the whole house feel different.
Yes.
So, and that's very female. And then the presents underneath the skirts, you know, so the tree has sort of produced them. You know. So it's she's a double of Santa Claus, right?
I'll never look at a tree the same way again. I promise. I want to talk to you about food.
Food.
Yes. And you do have a chapter about Christmas pudding. Yes. I want to know about this. There's more fat in a Christmas pudding than in everything we eat all year. Is combined, right?
Well, it's sugar too. It's not only fat, but also plenty of sugar. And it's incredible. This is, of course, a very Anglo-Saxon thing. Nobody else is crazy enough to have this round thing. But it's very good, you see, because it's a festive food. And what you want with a festive food is something that you don't want to eat again for a year. You know? And this is perfect. Christmas pudding does that. And it sort of feels terribly, terribly ancient, although it isn't as old as it looks.
How old is it?
Well, you can take it back to the Middle Ages and think of soups, because originally it was a soup, Christmas pudding. It was a plum porridge or plum broth. And what it was a meat soup, lots of hunks of meat in it, and then fruit added. The idea of dividing meat from sugar is a very modern one. If you eat Moroccan food, for example, they've kept the old way of having meat and then putting sugar on their meat.
Right. Yes.
And this is what we did then. And it was a porridge, and it remained a soup that you had at the beginning of the meal, not the end, the beginning, for right up until the mid-19th century. Meanwhile, there was also the British invented the pudding cloth. Now, I have to say, the word pudding originally meant sausage. It's the same word as boudin in French. Mm-hmm. And these puddings were put inside a paunch or a gut, like where sausages were.
Yeah.
And when the British invented the pudding cloth, you could do away with guts and use this cloth, a buttered piece of cloth. And this is very, very important for British cuisine, because at the time everybody was eating, cooked their food in a cauldron hanging over the fire, you know, like the three little pigs. Remember the wolf that fell through into the cauldron? That's how everybody ate. And it was very democratic to have that, because everybody had this cauldron. Meanwhile, the aristocrats had ovens, very chic to have an oven, right? And they had Christmas cake, which you needed an oven for. And the arrival of the Christmas pudding, which is a firmed-up soup wrapped in this cloth and cooked in the cauldron, boiling. And spreading of that is a sign of an enormous democratization, because it meant that everybody could have the Christmas pudding. Only the rich could have the Christmas cake, but everybody could have the pudding. So it's an interesting sort of change in mores. So that's what it represented in the 19th century. What it represents now, I mean, we you look at this and you say, what? You know, what
after all this,
prehistoric. It feels prehistoric. And it's dark. Very interesting. Yes. We love dark food. You know, chocolate or truffles. You know, anything that's black or brown. You know, it looks old and precious somehow. And then we set it alight, which makes it bizarre.
Why do we do that?
Well, Christmas has this whole thing about fire, which I was saying before.
Right.
That idea of warmth and love and so on. And but the Christmas pudding, lighting and turning all the lights off and lighting this thing, it's very festive. It makes you feel that this is weird. Aren't we being weird, you know? And then the fire thing, and then that weirdness. There's also a whole thing about darkness at Christmas. People tell ghost stories, and they sit around the fireplace, which is always the site of ghosts. It's a ghosty place. And Christmas is where you tell ghost stories as well. Because you see, what happens in Christmas is you're linked with both with the underworld and with heaven. And that's why the chimney is so important, because the chimney is the way from the sky, and also connection with the underworld.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's an underworld heaven opening up of the universe, which is important for the Christmas story.
Sheila Rogers with Margaret Visser in 1994. Margaret Visser has written six books about the anthropology and history of everyday life. She was also a Massey lecturer in 2002 when she talked about the role of fate in our lives. And you can find links to her books on the Rewind website, which is at cbc.ca/rewind. And please send us a note. You've been hearing about some of the more common customs of Christmas, but does your family have a particular tradition that you do every year at this time of year? Whether or not you celebrate Christmas, ritual means something to all of us, of course, and we'd love to know about yours. So our email address is rewind@cbc.ca. Again, that's rewind@cbc.ca. Rewind is produced by Marika Mayer, with the help on the website from Barb Dickey. I'm Michael Enright. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.
Wow. She had a lot of experience. She had this very aristocratic British accent, and she's so broad in her field of knowledge and discussion and everything, and she's so excited and all. My goodness. Incredible. Thanks, Doc.
That was fascinating, Rick. That was really great. And it was nice to hear Peter Zobskin and Michael Enright. Sunday morning was a tradition for me. I used to listen to Sunday morning all the time here, and I miss it.
And I liked it when she talked about the Christmas pudding and all of that kind of stuff. And the best gifts that I like to give are ones that, hey, if you don't want it, if you've already got this, I'll gladly take it back. I'm perfectly fine with that. Some things I just give to people because they want them, and they tell me, you know, okay, can you grab me this? But the best ones, if I give something to somebody and it's totally unexpected, if you give it back, I have no problem with that.
Wow. I enjoyed that show too, Rick. You know what? I hope we all take the stuff that we played today and put it in the RMR folder so we can all copy it and have... I'm recording this thing anyway just in case, but it'd be nice to have the original copies. Hey, good job, Rick. I like that show. Lots of interesting customs.
Well, I missed all the comments except for Max's because I was switching around. I'm just glad to see people were still here. I know it got to be kind of long-winded. Anyway, glad that you survived it. Glad some of you even liked it. And Max, I'm looking forward to what you're doing.
Yeah, but she was fascinating because she's so got that such aristocratic British voice, and she's... so broad in her knowledge and everything. Wow, incredible show.
Well, my comment, Rick, was for you, and I didn't want you to miss this. I really enjoyed hearing Michael Enright again and Peter Zobsky. I loved to listen to Sunday Morning. Sunday Morning was something I never missed when I can caught it as often as I could, and I missed that so much. That was a great program.
So, Doc, and you may not know this, is she still around, this lady?
I think so, Michael, because Michael would have mentioned something in the show. If you know, if she had died, he would have mentioned such. Yeah, I agree with you too, Ron. I got away from CBC quite a few years ago, but I love Zosky. He was just a great guy. And, of course, Enright's still around, as you've heard.
Yeah, and they said she was some kind of a speaker in the early to mid-2000s or something like that. So hopefully she's still around. She's still with us.
Yep. I really liked that stuff, and I put the Beverly Hillbillies, like the three episodes I've got with description, in the RMR folder for those that want it. It's from Movies for the Blind podcast, so each episode has an introduction and closing theme, and they introduce the show they're going to do and stuff like that.
Michael Enright, I've heard him before. He sounds sort of sophisticated himself. I mean, he sounds, you know, like... I wouldn't say aristocratic, but like I said, sophisticated.
Well, I see his picture on the site, and he looks to be almost a grandfatherly type, bespectacled, etc. And so he's been a veteran broadcaster for a long time. I don't know if I'd say aristocratic, but certainly, I guess sophisticated to a degree, but he's an okay guy. It's too bad about Zosky. I mean, we lost him, I don't know how many years ago. He was just, if you listen to his different things he did, it was just very comfortable. You might be interested or not, Max, but I discovered the other day that the Beverly Hillbillies that we were playing is not the first time Beverly Hillbillies appeared in media. I have just doing a program the other night, and it's a country and western type show, different performers. And there was a chap, and his backup group was called the Beverly Hillbillies.
Jack Benny. Yeah, I don't know. It's just something about Mike Glenn, right? It was just comfortable listening to him, and same with Peter. Just comfortable listening to those guys. They just were very, very wonderful to listen to. And they said, I miss Sunday morning. I thought that was the greatest thing since sliced bread. Fortunately, we had some stations carried here in the States, which was really nice because we could hear it easier that way. You used to listen to it on shortwave, though, sometimes too, but it was nice when the stations here in the States started carrying it.
Well, of course, you hear Lav Zosky on Rewind because they use a lot of his segments from Morningside. And what was good about him was he was just an ordinary guy. I mean, he would ask questions and get into things that you and I would ask if we were there, not just the, you know, expected kind of interview type stuff. So that's what made it interesting to me.
I rather think that's why it was why I have to use the adjective of comfortable. He was so comfortable to listen to, and just that's got to be the best way to describe that.
Who else would spend time on CBC Radio describing how to learn how to tie a tie?
You're right.
Wow, that's pretty funny. What's weird, like back in the day, I listened to CBC, but I liked, as it happens, sometimes they had some interesting stuff on, but I didn't get into Peter Zosky. Now I'm into him. But I think when you're younger, you know, it's harder to get into stuff that's more intellectual when you're a teenager, you know.
Yeah, of course, Enright was with As It Happens for quite a few years after Maitland died. Yeah, I don't know if I'd say Zosky was an academic, but I agree with you, Max, because I grew up with listening to CBC, like it's sort of a mandatory, you know, in this country, to listen to CBC or else you're not Canadian. And then by the time I got in my 20s, there are a few programs that I'm sure you or maybe you weren't around for it, but Ron certainly was for Finkelman's 45s and a few other things, Max Ferguson and Basic Black, of course, and we all listened to the Vinyl Cafe. But we kind of, at least I did, it kind of drifted away. And I know from listening to Tall Guy, you know, there's a lot of good stuff on CBC I never even heard about. In fact, if it wasn't for actually Katra, I wouldn't have caught on to a lot of good CBC stuff because I didn't know it was there until we started playing it. I'm glad there's chunks of Zosky around there because it's, you'd name it. I mean, nothing was sacred, but he would just go into his ordinary stuff. And when you have politicians on, they would just talk about things that you and I would ask them, not so much necessarily about big policies or whatever. He would get curious. He'd send, and I guess this is part of Rewind stuff too, but he would send guys out to see what can you buy for a dollar these days? Well, this is back in the 90s. You know, I give you a dollar. How many items can you buy? Useful items can you buy for a dollar? You know, and then he'd come back with reports of what they could pick up. You know, things like that. Just not really off the wall so much, but things that you and I would discuss here. So, like Ron said, it was just... it was a great way to spend the mornings. It's too bad I didn't listen to it in those days because I could have at the office. I just didn't do it.
They said I did a lot here. And, it's neat that you should bring up Alan Maitland and Barbara Frahm. My goodness, those were wonderful days. Oh, my gosh. As It Happens, it was wonderful to listen to then. My gosh, that was wonderful.
Yeah, I think it's still pretty good, although I don't listen to it. I guess I'm one of these retro guys that, you know, once Maitland and Frahm were gone, I kind of lost interest. And, of course, my life went in different circles, and I just wasn't around at that time of day. But it was kind of a groundbreaker in the way they operated. And if you listen to it, like you did, Ron, you know what I'm getting at. It wasn't shocking or anything, but, you know, they would phone anybody about anything. They'd catch things in the news, and, you know, they had no quarrel about phoning somebody and England at 5 o'clock in the morning, who was they'd read about having, you know, a quintuplet cows or something or whatever, anything that was kind of caught their interest. It wasn't that they looked for everything off the wall, but if it happened to be there, they'd pursue it. In the meantime, they also did the major stories. You know, they would interview some of the rebels in the Irish situation. In fact, I think there's something in one of the archives where, I don't know if it was planned, but Barbara Frum was actually talking to somebody who was holding someone hostage in a political situation. And they were being shot at. You know, and she's talking to them on the phone while the army is shooting at the house the guy's in.
Wow, that would be fascinating to hear. My goodness.
Yeah, that stuff was great. Yeah, I don't think people realize how good you had it, how rich that thing was. But, oh, my gosh, listening to it here in the States, we could have learned a lot from that. And I don't know, I guess all things considered is something similar, but nothing on that plane, I guess, is what I want to say. It is just good stuff. Yeah, they were good because you never knew what they were going to do next, and I was fascinated with that program, and I would listen to it a lot here. Really enjoyed that, but it's not quite the same as it was.
Wow, that sounds like an Art Bell broadcast, you know. Listen to this guy as he's flying into Area 51, you know. We've got a recording of this. Yeah, listen to us as we're negotiating with hostages while they're being shot at.
Yeah, you're right. I don't think it was a case that Canadians didn't recognize what they had. I think it was more of a case that the stupid CBC, well, it wasn't their fault, the stupid government slashed and burned CBC. For years and years, they've been chopping away at it since it wasn't really a commercial enterprise to start with. It was government-funded. Now, of course, it's had to go commercial to survive. But they took their budget, and they knocked 90% of it out. You just can't run on nothing, and I think that's what caused the demise of a lot of this stuff. Was it just wasn't there anymore, and it wasn't because people weren't listening, as you know, Ron, because I used to hear the advertising too for people in the States. Anybody who grabbed it from PBS or whoever else was carrying it ate it up, and we heard no end of comments about how good it was. But typical Canadian, you know, if something's good, we got to kill it, which means I don't have long to live.
My goodness. I used to like the Royal Canadian Air Force. That was really a good radio show. Too bad they cut that off.
Yeah, it was, Max. And it took me a little while to get into it. But that and a few of the other programs that came along at that time slot that came in after Basic Black on Saturday mornings, there's some terrific talent there. And it wasn't something you really had to be Canadian to enjoy. Yeah, so you're right. I mean, there was a lot of stuff. Of course, a lot of the people are in the States now. So, you know, good old Canada. Let's make something good and give it away, like our oil, our wheat, etc. Boy, it's a sure good thing we're taking over the U.S., or we'd be in real trouble.
Oh, my goodness. And also there's, do you remember Quirks and Quarks or something like that? It was a science show that Bob McDonald would talk all about different things.
Yeah, in fact, it just celebrated its anniversary. Now, I got to be honest, I wasn't into science enough that I really listened to it much, but I did hear it, and it did go through some wide-ranging things. Now, CBC had a great reputation for covering everything. I mean, you'd have a gardening show followed by Quirks and Quarks, and Bob Keith, the Ontario gardener, followed by Just Mary and her kid stories. And then you'd have, I forget who did this, but the over 90 birthday greetings for people in Ontario and Quebec, you know. Only in Canada, you say, eh? Pity.
One time I heard a program in between 97 and 99 where they interviewed someone who, I don't know if they had a psychological way that they interpreted dreams. It wasn't like anything spiritual, but you'd tell them your dream and they'd tell you what they thought it meant. It was an interesting show.
Oh, what about cross-country checkup, Rick?
Yeah, I was thinking about that one, Ron. I remember running into that in the 60s. And I wasn't that I really, again, like I wasn't listening to CBC a lot. But when I was down in Windsor, CBC had a repeater transmitter from Toronto. And CBC out of Windsor. And when I was there, sometimes I'd listen to it because it was kind of a touch of home because I was getting a lot of the network programs. So coming back on the train, quite often I'd be leaving about 5 o'clock, and so checkup would be on, and there wasn't much else I could grab in the train window. You know, AM radio was kind of tricky on a train. So I would listen to that in particular. You know, that wasn't an exciting program, but it was a way of keeping in touch. It was sort of like the old Northern Service of sending messages back and forth, because they would just throw a question out, and then people just phone in all over the country what their thoughts were. So it was a good barometer. And I know people like Diefenbaker and other politicians would listen to it because it gave them a clue as to maybe certain parts of the country were, you know, feeling a certain way about an issue and others weren't and that sort of thing. So that's still around, I think.
Interesting.
Hi, everybody. I checked back in the 60s because I was married to a Canadian, and one of my cousins had lent us a Blaupunkt shortwave, and I loved that set. I hated to have to give it back to him, but I had to. But we would listen to cross-country checkup, and at that time, probably around 1965, 66, a guy named Brad Crandall, who was an American, who had a show on WNBC, New York, I guess that he would fly to wherever the cross-country checkup was taking place and do the show. And I don't think at that time they had a way that it could be done, like, from a studio in New York. Or maybe they did. But I had the feeling, I think he said that he flew up to Canada every Sunday to do it. And he really was very well read on Canadian politics and Canadian life. And he did a very good job, but he was not Canadian.
I won't argue the point, Joni, because you're so much better versed than I am. But my recollection is listening to Brad Crandall back in the 50s on CKUY in Toronto. And he did a phone-in show on CKUY, which was sort of a competitor to Larry Solway's Speak Your Mouth and Chum, which was one of the biggies in that burgeoning phone-in type of program. So I'm thinking that he started in Canada, in Toronto. When he got big enough in Toronto, he went to New York. He would fly back into Toronto to do a cross-country checkup, and as you know, eventually just stayed in New York. But you may know more about than I do, but I was listening to him about 10 years before you were.
He was also a monitor host for a while. We've got sections of him on monitor.
No, Rick, of course you were right, because I didn't know that about him being in Toronto 10 years before that. You are right.
Well, I don't want to make a big deal over it. There could be a lot more than I remember, because remember, back in 55, 56, 57, I was just getting into radio. In fact, I discovered there were stations outside of CJBC, by the time I got to be 8 years old in 58. So there's a lot I don't remember, but I do know when I came to Woodstock, and my cousin, who was my roommate at that point, it was a normal guy and listened to radio, different radio stations, and of course CKUY was one of the rock stations in Toronto. So we got to listen to actually two or three of the guys from EY ended up big in the States. So, and Chum as well. That's sort of natural, becoming out of Toronto. I was just thinking of Ron's comment. Forget what it was, but I know I was something I was going to say about that. But you're right, Ron. I do remember. Yeah, I got some of that monitor stuff too. Yeah, and I remember hearing him on monitor, because we'd feel very proud, right, that the Canadian made good in those days. Now, of course, they're all over the place, including Alex Trebek. Of course, in the CBC days, when he was reading the CBC News at 8 o'clock in the morning, he was Alex Trebek.
They're everywhere.